This is The Takeaway. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, host of WNYC's New Tech City, in for John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. In a few moments, we'll talk to investigative reporter Peter Moss about the rare access he was given to interview NSA leaker Edward Snowden and his behind-the-scenes look at the two reporters with whom Snowden shared his secrets. It's a revealing portrait of modern-day investigative journalism. And later this hour, a look at the advantages and disadvantages posed by our smartphones, how they're changing the way we do things, from hailing taxicabs to having a relationship and even throwing a wedding. But we want to begin in Egypt. Egyptian military forces cleared out two pro-Morsi camps in Cairo overnight. There are reports of armored vehicles, bulldozers, and tear gas being used by government forces against supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi, and unconfirmed reports of dozens of fatalities. Muslim Brotherhood officials are calling it a massacre. The sound of gunfire in Cairo. We're seeing crowds running, clouds of tear gas. Complete chaos in the capital. David Kirkpatrick is in Cairo for our partner, The New York Times, and I just want to read to you some of what David has been tweeting. Blocks from Rabah Sidon in Cairo, soldiers are firing live ammunition at a lone young man throwing rocks from a roof. Morsi supporters are outside, have no weapons, but are attempting to make Molotov cocktails, break rocks, futile. That's a tweet from David Kirkpatrick, who also says the number of dead bodies in a makeshift morgue nearby rose from 3 to 12 in the 15 minutes that he was there. Reports backed up by pictures of what appear to be dozens of dead bodies. And here's another tweet from David. We were pinned down by gunfire, trying to find the alleged safe exit from the outside. Safe now. And it would appear that the violence isn't just in the capital. Churches are reported to have been set on fire in other parts of the country. So far, appeals for calm are being ignored. David says Egypt's most respected Muslim cleric, the Imam of Al-Azhar, has made a televised statement calling for an end to the violence. Louisa Lovelock, freelance reporter based in Cairo, is filing for the Global Post, and she's on the line with us now. Louisa, what's been going on?
Well, it's been an incredibly bloody day in Cairo and further afield across Egypt. In the early hours of this morning, police and military forces surrounded two pro-Morsi encampments in East Cairo and subsequently appear to have killed a huge number of people. It seems that the death toll at the moment stands at around 140, although we can certainly expect to see this rise throughout the evening.
So you sound really calm. Where are you and what have you been seeing?
Well, I've just got back to my apartment, so it's slightly easier to be calm here. I spent about 2 or 3 hours trying to get into the Rabah sit-in this morning, which is the large one.
That's where the protesters have been having a sit-in for weeks, right?
Yes, they've had a sit-in for the last month protesting the deposition of President Mohamed Morsi. Unfortunately, the police and military had surrounded the area, and not only were they killing people inside, but they were also shooting at anyone who tried to enter using tear gas, birdshot, and even live ammunition. So it was very, very difficult to get in, and because of the fact that the phone signal was largely jammed due to the networks being overloaded, there was a near news blackout from inside.
Now, did the people that were around there, were they surprised that this was happening? Had they been expecting that there would be a move by the military today?
People have expected a move for a while now, but there keep being rumors that it will happen and then it never quite materializes. Although people sort of were expecting the worst, I'm not sure that they quite expected something as bad as we've seen today. And I actually made it into the sit-in in the end. And it was in a very confined space. It was the closest thing I've ever seen to a war zone. You've still got thousands of people in there determined to hold their ground. They are facing live ammunition from the police. There's tear gas is hanging in the air. It's very, you can feel it. It stings your face. And there are repeated volleys still going in. But people aren't leaving. You have women, you have children, you have old men sort of sitting under tents whilst their fellow protesters face up against the police, climb up on barricades and chant. But the question now is, if this continues, what happens after dark?
So, Louisa, does today feel different? Does this feel kind of like a turning point? Because it's kind of been like a slow-moving train wreck over there.
Well, it's certainly the bloodiest day I've ever known in Egypt. But the problem is the Muslim Brotherhood are so isolated that there is a very good chance that the military and police will not receive the sort of condemnation domestically that they should, because there is a very strong belief here that the Muslim Brotherhood are terrorists, that they are all armed with weapons. There have been a lot of rumors and reports to suggest that there's been torture going on inside the camp over the past month. So they don't necessarily have public opinion on their side, and that will certainly be very significant in the weeks that follow as we try to recover from this terrible, terrible day.
Louisa, thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks very much.
Louisa Lovelock, freelance reporter based in Cairo for the Global Post. When leaker Edward Snowden decided to reveal the full extent of the NSA's surveillance programs, he turned not to the Washington Post or the New York Times. No, Snowden set his sights on a new brand of journalist, the Woodward and Bernstein of the 21st century. Snowden found allies in two longtime activists that work within and without the mainstream media. Documentary filmmaker Laura Poitras and Guardian columnist Glenn Greenwald took up Snowden's cause. And through encrypted chat conversations, Laura helped investigative reporter Peter Moss conduct an interview with Snowden from his new home in Russia. Peter Moss published his interview with Snowden for this week's issue of the New York Times Magazine, which you can find now online. And he spoke to us about how Snowden first chose to pursue Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald to leak NSA secrets.
Well, I had gone down to Rio to spend some time with Laura and Glenn Greenwald, who also has been reporting on this NSA story with her and has been writing most of the stories. And I had begun talking with Laura more than a year ago about writing a story about her. This is long before Edward Snowden was on anybody's radar, including hers. And so I went down to Rio, spent some time with her, and then we went our separate ways. I went back to New York. She went to Berlin. And as kind of I was just finishing up my research and doing some fact-checking with her, she said, "Do you want to ask some questions to Snowden?" And I said, "Sure." And she hadn't asked him if he'd answer, but she said, "Send me some questions and I'll send them to him." She's in regular contact with him through encrypted means. And she passed them on to him. He decided to answer them. He answered them, sent them back to her. She sent them back to me every stage of the way it was encrypted.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating reading. So how did he explain to you why he chose Laura Poitras and her reporting partner, the Guardian columnist Glenn Greenwald, to get out his information?
It was really interesting and really unique. He chose them not because they work for the biggest publications in the world, which neither one of them do. He chose them because they had similar political sympathies, similar ideas that he had. And in particular with Laura Poitras, he knew that she had been under surveillance herself and that she was probably capable of conducting encrypted communications, which he required. He actually tried to contact Glenn Greenwald initially first. But Greenwald didn't have encrypted communications and didn't really kind of want to get up to speed on that, so just kind of ignored Snowden's requests. And so he went to Poitras. And Poitras, who's been under surveillance, has been stopped at airports more than 40 times, who's working on a film about surveillance, and who is leading a very encrypted kind of life. She was able to offer the encryption and the security that Snowden required in order to be able to disclose the NSA files.
I mean, I kind of had to laugh. Snowden told you that Laura and Glenn seemed annoyed when they first arrived in Hong Kong to meet him. Why were they annoyed, and how did they come to trust each other?
Well, they had been communicating for about a month or two, and they had received some documents from Snowden, and they knew that this was somebody who had access to the biggest secrets of the American government, the NSA. And they assumed that this had to be somebody who was relatively high level, because, you know, only high level people would really kind of know this much or have access to this much. And they just didn't really realize until they saw him in Hong Kong, wait a minute, this isn't a mid-level or senior level official from the NSA. This is a kid. He was 29 years old at the time, but Laura and Glenn both told me he looks younger than 29. He looks about 23 years old when you see him. So they were just utterly floored, shocked that this was the guy they'd been communicating with, that this was the guy who was handing over to them the deepest, biggest secrets of the United States government. They just never expected it would be a 29-year-old computer whiz.
And I have to say, this is sort of the first time we've heard about the personal side of the NSA scandal. Why do you think Laura and Glenn let you behind the scenes with them to watch them, how they work? It really is like a thriller, a movie, reading it.
Well, it goes back to more than a year ago when I first contacted Laura because I was really interested in the work that she was doing on this surveillance documentary and the story that she already had lived herself. That is, somebody who's been under surveillance by the American government. And so I already had a relationship with Laura. And then once the Snowden thing happened, I got back in touch with her and said, you know, do you want to do this? Can I come and do a story about you? So since she knew me and since she knew that my interest wasn't based just on the big headline of the moment, she agreed to let me come down there and watch her and Glenn do their thing and talk about how it all happened. And I think the reason that she and Glenn decided to do that, beyond just, you know, her having known me previously, is because, you know, they'd been slammed in some ways and, you know, misconstrued and described in ways that maybe they didn't think were accurate and probably weren't accurate. And so they felt that, you know, it would be good to have somebody tell the story of really what happened, how it worked out, what they're trying to do. And so they trusted me, and so they let me come and observe what was going on, and they talked to me about what was going on.
And I have to say, your observations are kind of hilarious. Like, your one description of Glenn Greenwald working from his home in Brazil with a monkeys in the backyard yelling at his 10 dogs. It's kind of, when you're reading all of these very intense articles about the NSA program, these sort of, it seems very vague in a way, but details like this sort of bring it to life.
Well, what it brings to life is the really unusual situation that we're in terms of how investigative reporting can be done these days. It's, you know, a lot of great investigative reporting is still done in the newsrooms of the New York Times and the Washington Post and so forth. But it's also done in places like this, in a house pretty much in the jungle in Rio by a guy in his flip-flops and surfer shorts, along with a documentarian who's been under surveillance by the United States government. There's a real role that these kind of outsider journalists play now. And it's a role that actually, you know, is chosen in some ways by their sources. It's not by chance that these outsider journalists, Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald, got this scoop. It was actually because they were outsiders that they got it. Because Snowden didn't trust the New York Times or the Washington Post enough. But he did trust, because he had seen their writing, Glenn Greenwald's, and he had seen Laura Poitras' documentary work. He trusted that they would, A, understand what he was trying to do, that they would not betray him, and that they would, most importantly, get the information out.
Peter, briefly, what was your biggest surprise in researching this piece?
The biggest surprise was that I found this amazing combination of kind of like The Odd Couple meets Woodward and Bernstein in Poitras and Greenwald, because you had this very quiet, very firm, very kind of encryption-savvy documentary filmmaker, along with this garrulous, incredibly opinionated writer who wears flip-flops and surfer shorts all day long. And these were the two people who broke this huge story. And as unlikely as they seem individually and particularly in combination, in fact, it is that unlikeliness that made this happen, because Snowden did not want to go to people he couldn't trust. And so it was not just the fact that this was an unlikely, odd couple, you know, Woodward and Bernstein type of thing. It was because it was that which made this whole thing happen. Because I really think that there aren't a lot of other journalists out there who Snowden would have felt comfortable going to. So if Greenwald and Poitras hadn't been there, I don't know if this would have happened.
It's a fascinating read and really a great portrait of modern day journalism. Thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you.
Peter Moss is an investigative reporter whose recent interview with Edward Snowden is online now for the New York Times Magazine. And coming up, why the London Whale, the man behind a $6.2 billion loss for J.P. Morgan, won't be held accountable. That's coming up on The Takeaway. I'm Anoush Zomorodi, and this is The Takeaway. In 2012, former J.P. Morgan Chase trader Bruno Ixell made headlines as the London Whale for losing $6.2 billion in a series of trades that went south. Despite these disastrous bets, the U.S. Department of Justice has announced that Ixell won't be facing any charges. But in the past few hours, it's emerged that the U.S. is going after two other former J.P. Morgan Chase employees for their roles in the London Whale scandal. Charges have now been brought against two derivatives traders for conspiracy, fraud, falsifying books, and making false statements. Heidi Moore is finance and economics editor for The Guardian U.S. and helped explain the charges being brought down today.
Well, they're bringing charges against Javier Martín Artajo, who ran the London operations of what was known as J.P. Morgan's chief investment office. It was this really powerful investing arm of the bank that controlled $350 billion. So Martín Artajo was really the head trader, and he was the one who oversaw all of the trades and who was essentially the boss. There were people above him, but he was the one with real tangible power. And then the other person is Julian Grout, and he is a trader whose job it was to make sure that he knew the correct values of all the trades. As you know, throughout the day, the value of stocks and bonds move around. And so it was his job at the end of the day to make sure the bank knew how much money was on the line.
So how did Ixell get the immediate blame? Why do we all know his name?
Well, he became famous because it was his idea to put on this really big trade, which we now call the London Whale Trade. And so he had the idea to take this bet on stock indexes involving really big companies. And he went with the bet, and then he saw after a while that he was losing money, and he started panicking. Uh-huh. And he said, I want to get out of this trade. And his bosses said, if you get out of this trade, you'll lose money. And he said, well, I'm willing to lose the money. And they said, well, you know what? We're not. Keep going with your trade. And so they basically forced him to double down and double down and double down. And in his emails, which we know about from a Senate subcommittee report, he really expressed a lot of despair. He thought, I need to get out of this thing. I am a sitting duck in the markets because everyone knows I have this massive trade and they're all taking the other side just to ruin my profit. And he was trying to get out, but his bosses would not let him. And, of course, we know then it ballooned to billions of dollars.
So if everybody knew that, why weren't they like, yeah, get out, let's cut our losses?
Well, it's really hard. You know, there's a – I don't want to use necessarily the gambling metaphor, but there is a kind of a gambling mentality when you're losing that much money. We're talking about billions of dollars. And it's really hard for people to accept – especially banks, to accept that they're just going to have to say, fine, we're getting out of this $1 billion of losses. I mean, $1 billion of losses is hard to accept. So what they wanted to do was hope that they could somehow turn it around. You know, like the Titanic is kind of going down. Maybe you can somehow pull it back up. But of course, we know it already hit the iceberg.
So why now are they saying, actually, Ixell won't be charged? Is there some sort of bargain that's going on here?
I would imagine that there is. And, you know, also I think that almost as a society, we really owe Ixell a little bit of an apology because he was really painted as the villain in all of this, as, you know, the reckless gambler who took on all of this, you know, debt during the course of the trade and who listened to nobody. And that clearly was not the correct narrative. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he's providing significant information. But also we know from a Senate subcommittee report that he really showed a lot of worry about the course of this trade.
Do you remember any of the emails in particular?
There were a lot of emails, you know, from him to his intern, you know, these kind of emails of despair. No one's listening to me. We're really screwed. You know,
it almost makes you feel sorry for the guy.
Sort of, except, you know, it's really first world problems.
I mean, well, that's
but,
for sure.
Yeah, but he was a form of a whistleblower on himself, oddly, but no one would listen to him. So it's almost Kafka-esque. He knew what was going wrong.
Do you think this happens? I mean, you know, you talk to a lot of people in the business. Do you think this happens a lot where people are kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place?
Oh, all the time. I mean, there are really hard decisions that are made on a trading floor, especially because you're between money, right? Everyone is there for the same goal, allegedly, which is, you know, aligned towards profit. But also, you know, there's this issue of autonomy. And a lot of people on trading floors feel like they have autonomy, but they really don't. And, you know, it's a constant, you know, pushback from leadership. This is, you shouldn't be betting on this. You should be betting on this. We're not going to let you do that. You know, they're very closely monitored and watched and, you know, and they don't always get their way. We see them as these cowboys of Wall Street.
Right.
And that's not necessarily the case.
So at the end of the day, what kind of repercussions do you think we might see for financial markets from a criminal case against either of those two individuals who are higher up? Could we see potentially, I'm going to ask a silly question, trading become a more ethical practice?
Well, let's not get crazy. the markets themselves will probably be fine, and so will J.P. Morgan. I mean, don't forget, J.P. Morgan came through this just fine because it was a relatively strong bank. But what it does show is that it's part of a trend of regulators and investigators really trying to hold Wall Street to account more and more often. We've seen we saw an SEC win a case last week against a Goldman Sachs trader. We've seen the Department of Justice pursue Bank of America for mortgage-backed securities. So we're definitely in a kind of a new era of aggression on these Wall Street wrongs. As far as this London Whale Trade goes, it's not as bad as it could have been, right? J.P. Morgan recovered. The bank is now profitable. So, you know, the question of whether this is really going to be a deterrent to other traders.
Is this truly significant? I mean, I feel like every time we hear about something like this, they're like, but now they made all their money back and it's just fine.
Well, you know, I think that's an important point, because there was a time when banks wouldn't be fined from this kind of risky behavior. But what's really interesting about it is that the DOJ is showing that it's willing to go after trading bosses, not just the lowest guy on the totem pole. And so, you know, if people are paying attention, which they probably will only do for a year or two because memories are short, it'll show trading bosses that they should be paying closer attention to the kind of risk they have on the line, even if their bank can survive the trouble.
Right. Heidi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Heidi Moore is finance and economics editor for The Guardian U.S. Just hours before a new round of Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations were to begin today in Jerusalem, the Israeli military struck two sites in Gaza following rocket fire from Palestinians the night before. The exchange of strikes came as Israeli officials released 26 Palestinian prisoners. They have promised to release 78 more over the coming months. But this week, Israeli officials also announced plans to build more than 1,000 housing units in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, enraging Palestinian leaders and leading some to question Israel's commitment to the peace talks. Take a listen to this comment from senior Palestinian official Hanan Ashrari.
The deliberate and willful sabotage of these talks and of any prospects of a genuine peace is embodied in Israel's escalated and persistent policy of settlement activity and settlement expansion.
But Secretary of State John Kerry says he isn't surprised. He sees the announcement as further evidence of the importance of peace talks.
What this underscores, actually, is the importance of getting to the table quickly, and resolving the questions with respect to settlements.
So what are the chances of a breakthrough and a resumption of a credible peace process? Chaim Malka, deputy director and senior fellow in the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks so much for being here.
Good to be with you.
So, Chaim, I just want to start by asking, Kerry seems to really be trying to jumpstart this peace process, inserting himself in this. What, with all the turmoil going on in Egypt and Syria in the region, what is the significance as to the timing of Washington sort of getting back in the action here?
Secretary of State really made this a hallmark issue for him when he entered office. He and other people in the U.S. administration believe that the window to reach a final status agreement or a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is really fading away. And he is committed to trying to restart the talks, despite the difficulties and the challenges and the pessimism on both sides.
Yeah, I mean, some of those challenges are that he's not just dealing with two sides. You know, the two sides who are officially coming to the table, there's Hamas and the settlers. How much leverage do those at the negotiating table really have?
Look, the Prime Minister of Israel and the President of the Palestinian Authority are running these talks. They have domestic constituencies that they have to deal with. Certainly, Prime Minister Netanyahu's government is a very right-wing government. It's one of the more right-wing governments that Israel's had in probably 30 years. And that's one of the reasons why the government announced new settlement construction projects at the time of the launch of the negotiations. President Abbas also has to deal with Hamas in Gaza, which he doesn't control, and a lot of skepticism within the Palestinian population about the utility of these talks.
And so what incentives do you think the Israelis and Palestinians have to stay at the negotiating table if they are sort of balancing so many demands?
There's a lot of pressure from the United States as well, and we have to keep that in mind. Neither side wanted to enter these talks, but there was considerable pressure from the United States to try to move forward. There's been a 9-month time frame for reaching a final status agreement. That's a very ambitious goal, but if the two sides can reach smaller agreements on issues like borders, on security, perhaps this process can move forward in a positive way.
Yeah, so just to end real quick, in a best-case scenario, since I feel like we never get to talk about that with the Middle East peace talks, what would you like to see happen?
Again, if they can reach smaller steps, understandings on issues like borders and security along the way, then I think they can maintain some momentum for these talks.
Chaim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chaim Malka, Deputy Director and Senior Fellow in the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Taxi! Most city dwellers are familiar with the struggles of trying to flag down a cab when it's raining or freezing or both. But what if you could just hail a cab from your smartphone?
New apps like Halo, Uber, and Flywheel now allow passengers in cities including New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. to locate and hail cabs from their phones and pay online. In San Francisco, Flywheel is dispatching around 16,000 rides per month for about half of the city's cabs. Halo has more than 500 cabs working the streets of Chicago every day. But in New York City, the on-demand taxi app has been slow to catch on. A recent report found that trips arranged by smartphone during the first month these were available in June, they accounted for less than 0.25% of all yellow taxi rides. And after this info came out, I tweeted about it, writing, "Old habits die hard for New Yorkers." And the woman sitting next to me, Stacey Marie Ishmael, tweeted back. And Stacey, what did you say?
Brown people disagree.
Stacey Marie Ishmael is a product manager at a tech startup and an advocate for minorities and tech. And Stacey, why do you say that brown people disagree?
I think one of the advantages of these kinds of apps is they remove the uncertainty that you face that a cab driver will pass you by because they're profiling you based on how you look, expecting that you will maybe want to go to the outer boroughs like Brooklyn or Queens, or, you know, sort of more nefariously potentially be a criminal.
A criminal. Has this, and you feel like you've...
I've definitely experienced the, you're out late and you're trying to get a cab and you're the one with the strategic spot and you are getting passed by, or you and your group of friends are getting passed by for sort of people who look less brown.
You know, it's funny. I've heard of people, and I've actually seen it, you know, men on the street raising their hand and the taxi goes right on by, yep, even though they're empty and they're obviously looking for a fare. But it's very unusual that we hear that from a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you are sort of being profiled the same way as minority men?
When I am in groups with minority men, mm-hmm, it affects us as a group. When I've been alone, I had an interesting experience in that until very recently, I had extremely long dreadlocks and I wore a head wrap. And I would almost never get a cab. And then I cut all my hair off and stopped wearing a head wrap. And now I get a cab all the time.
Huh. So what do you think that these apps then do? Because when you use an app, they don't know what you look like?
Precisely. So I think there are kind of two elements there. One, it takes away the possibility that you're not going to want to take me somewhere because you think I live in the outer boroughs, or you are discriminating against me on the basis of, you know, you think I'm going to rob you, or I might commit some kind of random act of vandalism based on your profiling of me. And the second thing is, too, I think it gives a degree of safety for me. One of the things I like about some of these apps is you can actually share your location with someone.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, if you're getting into a cab late at night, I can actually send a text to somebody and say, hey, I'm in this cab and I'll be home shortly. And if I'm not home, like,
you know,
let me know.
Sound the alarm.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess we should also point out that the way people use these apps is going to vary from city to city. So maybe San Francisco and other places are a better fit than maybe New York.
I think also one of the challenges with New York is there had been so much back and forth around whether these were legal,
mm-hmm,
that there's a great deal of hesitation for people to actually use them because they don't know what the status is. And unlike in other cities, a lot of these apps, Halo in particular, don't take care of the transaction for you in terms of payment. So when I use Halo in London, I never have to give the taxi driver cash because it just accepts my credit card details in the app. The ride is done, I'm out, it's over. So it reduces that uncertainty. And I think one of the attractions of the apps in these other places is that if you don't have cash on you, you don't have to worry, well, maybe the cab driver isn't going to take my card.
I mean, from what you're saying, it almost seems like even if some New Yorkers don't get e-hailing, having it here in the city is worthwhile in a completely different way because they're bringing cabs to underserved areas and maybe underserved people.
I definitely think so. You know, I like talking to taxi drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first times I took Halo here, I asked the cab driver, well, when do you find this useful? And he said, well, really off peak, when he's just sort of trawling the city and doesn't know where he might find a fare, this is a much more directed and less wasteful way of him getting a, you know, a guaranteed fare than just driving around hoping somebody will be looking for a cab.
Stacey Marie, thank you so much for your time and for tweeting back at me.
Anytime, Manoush.
Stacey Marie Ishmael is a product manager at a tech startup. She writes and thinks a lot about minorities and tech.
The longest and costliest strike in the history of the steel industry hit the United States economy in 1959. The steel industry across the nation banked its furnaces, turned off the vital flow of steel. Many of the nation's auto plants closed down within a few months, their supply of steel used up.
Back in the 1950s, unions had hit their stride. Strikes could bring down entire industries and even force the intervention of the President of the United States.
I'm not going to try to assess any blame, but I'm getting sick and tired of the apparent impasse in the settlement of this matter. And I think so are the American people.
President Eisenhower ordered 500,000 striking steel workers back to their jobs, but the steel plants ultimately did meet the workers' demands. Today, America's unions are a shadow of their former selves. In 1973, a quarter of all American workers were members of a union. By 2012, that number had plummeted to 11.2%. But a new form of labor organization is making a difference in addressing the needs of some workers, especially immigrant workers, who get jobs that are typically not unionized. Christina Sinzun is the executive director of the Workers' Defense Project, and she's on the line with me now.
Hi, Manoush. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Christina. Your organization has had a lot of success in the otherwise flagging labor movement. What sort of working conditions are we talking about for the workers that you represent?
Well, our organization is based in Texas, and construction jobs in other parts of the country are good blue-collar jobs that are unionized. But in Texas, it's a conservative right-to-work state, and where half of the workforce in the construction industry are undocumented, we see some of the worst conditions in the country. So Texas is the most deadly place for construction workers. More construction workers die in Texas than in any other state. In fact, we have seen a slight decrease since we started working on this issue, but at its peak just a few years ago, 142 workers died in Texas in 1 year. That was meant a worker was dying every 2.5 days. And wow. We're the only state in the country also that doesn't require workers' compensation to help a worker when they're injured. And it's very common practice in the Texas construction industry for workers to not even be paid for their work or be paid $2, $3 an hour. So we're up against a really hard industry and seeing some of just atrocious conditions in the state of Texas. So what but that's why we're organizing to change that.
Yeah, and what do you do exactly to support these workers? Is it more about their working rights or their immigrant rights or both?
Well, I think for us, it's both. Workers' rights are immigrants' rights and vice versa. We're fighting to raise standards in the construction industry. Like the other over 200 worker centers in the country, we do that by providing direct services to workers when they're not paid to make sure that they get their wages back or make sure that they get the medical care they need and can stand up to their employers who try and violate their rights with impunity. But beyond that, we're trying to raise standards that go beyond legal minimums because we know what the minimum wage is now and the rights and protections that workers have now are really not good enough. And so in Texas, for instance, you don't even have a right to a rest break. We have workers regularly fainting on jobs and dying in heat exhaustion. And the city where I work in Austin, we are the only city in the state that workers now have the right to paid rest breaks to protect them. And it's just a basic gain, but it's something that we won and our members won that now we're hoping to take to other parts of the state.
Can you give me an example of something that you sort of brokered with a company? I understand Apple might be one of those companies.
Yeah, so our organization has also tried to look at how Texas is one of the fastest growing states in the country. But not everyone has benefited at the same rate from this growth. The economic miracle hasn't been trickled down to the workers that are doing some of the most dangerous and difficult jobs. So Apple was recently given close to $30 million in tax breaks to come build a new complex here in Austin. And we started to change the conversation in the city and at the county level and say, well, what about the construction workers? What kind of conditions are they going to face? And this is the first time that that conversation ever happened on these kinds of projects. And we won construction workers a living wage of $12 an hour. That was the lowest that anybody can be paid on that project. We won safety training, workers' compensation coverage, and then really importantly, we won the right to monitor all of those standards to make sure they're being adhered to and that workers get to benefit from those gains. And that's a huge victory for workers and I think particularly inspiring not just immigrant workers, but other folks and construction workers that are U.S. citizens. Because if immigrant workers can win these kinds of gains, I think it just shows that if we are well organized and thoughtful about our work that we can really make advancements for workers.
But, you know, traditional unions, even at the peak of their power, they were largely unable to represent immigrant workers. They were sort of immigrants were seen as stealing those native born Americans' jobs. So how do you see yourself different than unions? Do you feel a connection to sort of the union legacy or is this something completely different?
Well, I think we see ourselves as part of a broad labor movement of community groups, of churches, and faith partners that are taking interest in what happens to workers and seeing it as a core value of who we are as a country. So we do see ourselves an alliance with labor unions, but we see that the same with business partners as well that want to see better conditions for workers.
And you call it a conversation, right? Not so much a negotiation.
Right. We try and raise standards through community pressure and support, but we're doing that with a broad coalition. We're not doing that in the way that a union would do that. It's very different.
Christina, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Christina Zinzun is the executive director of the Workers' Defense Project. Her organization has had a lot of success in the flagging labor movement.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. Sometimes in our digital age, it can feel like very few big moments in life are left unrecorded, whether by email, text, or tweet. But how does all of this new technology fit into events that are considered to be inherently traditional? How does it work in a wedding? WNYC's New Tech City producer Dan Tucker recently went to a wedding and heard this speech.
Now through Gmail and Josh being dumb enough to blind copy me on all of her emails to Kate, I was able to uncover the email string for you all to hear now.
Okay, the man talking, Brian Crow, pieced together the courtship of Kate and Josh all through emails and GChat messages, and he delivered an extremely revealing toast at their wedding. Just to set it up, Josh first met Kate when his company placed an ad in Time Out Chicago, where Kate worked.
This is Josh first. Kate, it was a pleasure meeting you today, and thanks again. And thanks again for making some time for us. It really means a lot to have Time Out on board. If you're in town, you better be at our New Year's party. I'll buy you a drink. Winky face. This was the first initial string after they met at her office. And then after that string, Josh forwards me the email. And he just sends it to me and goes, I think she wants me.
Oh, the intimacy of these emails makes me squirm. But months later, we checked in with the groom, and he says he's thrilled with the detailed documentation of his budding love for Kate.
I think it's the coolest thing ever that you have this. It's really kind of a snapshot or a look in on a relationship that you really can't get.
Thanks so much to Dan Tucker, New Tech City producer, for exposing his friends' lives on The Takeaway. And while this kind of public sharing works for some people, it doesn't work for everyone, particularly when it comes to a wedding. So joining us now to weigh in on how wedding traditions are changing in the digital age is Anna Post, author and etiquette expert and the great-great-granddaughter of the queen of etiquette, Emily Post. Anna, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So Anna, have you ever been to a wedding where emails were read aloud?
You know, funny enough, I have. I was actually a bridesmaid in a wedding this past April, and the matron of honor, when she got up and gave her speech, she read an email from the bride describing sort of the first date impressions with the groom. It was read more sweetly, let's say, than the tone that the person giving the speech that we just listened to put onto, layered onto it.
Did it feel appropriate? I mean, could it make guests feel uncomfortable by sharing such intimate moments? Because it's funny, the older people I told this story to about that speech, they thought it was appalling, and the younger people felt it was wonderful.
You know, the one that I heard, I think, would have been reviewed as wonderful all around because it was, oh, I just met him. He was so sweet. We had a really nice time. I think I like him. I mean, it was very tame. It was very sweet. It was very awe-inspiring. And, you know, it didn't have more of that kind of, hey, I think she's hot kind of vibe to it, which is where I think the older guests are getting uncomfortable with it.
Right. Well, and it's not just emails, right? There are other digital dilemmas that are unavoidable at weddings these days, like tweeting and posting photos, right?
Yes. This is one that I'm hearing a lot about right now. Often I'm hearing about it from the couple's perspective. How do we prevent people from tweeting or posting photos? They're especially concerned about this ceremony, and I think they have more ground to stand on there than at the reception, which can almost feel like a reunion for some of the other guests,
mm-hmm.
too. But the ceremony, I think it's very fair to ask in a variety of different ways that people refrain from posting or even sometimes from taking photos with their smartphones. You know, you walk down the aisle, and instead of a sea of smiling faces, because you have a sea of reflective phones looking back at you instead. And I can understand couples wanting to limit that.
Yeah, I was just talking to one of the Takeaways producers, and she was saying it was so weird to see herself on Instagram, you know, basically minutes after she was married, that people sort of stuck those photos up there.
Right. And, you know, when you think about things like Twitter, who are you tweeting, all the people who weren't invited? I always have to wonder with that one a little bit. But, you know, as a guest, it's your job to really be part of the moment. And I think the ceremony especially, put it away and pay attention. And, you know, for the couple, in part, it's great. You know, you often don't get your photographs from the photographer sometimes for months later. Mm. So you can see some photos right away. But there is also a loss of privacy with it that you don't necessarily have control over anymore. So I think it's a give and a take. And a lot of it has to do with how people do these things.
So is it acceptable then for the bride and the groom to officially set boundaries? I mean, I recently heard about a couple that banned their guests from bringing their cell phones because they didn't want anyone, they wanted everyone to look at them, not be texting under the tables at the reception.
My take, you know, the ban on cell phones, I think, goes a little too far. For one thing, you most likely have parents there. And in this day and age, you're not going to be able to cut that babysitter tie via the phone. You're just not. And, you know, instead, what I like to see is multiple requests, you know, both on the ceremony program, somebody standing up and making announcements about, you know, please have all phones away during the ceremony. Huh. By the time you get to the reception, I think that it's a losing battle at that point.
Once the alcohol starts flowing, nobody's going to stick to that probably. But what about so other digital elements when it comes to wedding planning, like electronic invites or online registry requests? Do you feel like sort of, you know, I had so much fun, I have to say, choosing my wedding invitations all those years ago. They were so beautiful. They were letterpress. They were real. You could hold them in your hands.
I'm a big paper person. It sounds like you are too. And a lot of other people are as well. And do I think there's a day where we will have a etiquette world that says okay to digital invitations? I do. I don't think it's soon, though, and here's why. When you send out that wedding invitation, two things are happening in terms of digital impact. One is, are all of your guests using email regularly? Is there any chance it's being caught in a spam filter? Is your grandmother going to be able to receive this and understand it and not be so overwhelmed by wondering why is this an email instead of a printed invitation that she's not actually excited for the big event? Guest experience is part of what the invitation is about, and I don't think we're there yet with all generations of guests. Someday I think that may change. The other thing that happens is when you physically get that paper in the mail, I do think there's still a difference right now. We get a lot of bills, a lot of junk mail, maybe some magazines that you actually want, and then all of a sudden you get this heavy packet of paper. That tells you not just, ooh, it's nice and it's paper, but it tells you that we think this day is a really big deal. And when you reduce that to an email, when we get so many and it's usually about, you know, backyard barbecue next weekend, I think it puts it into a category that says maybe we're not taking this really as seriously as we're going to want you, our guests, to do on our actual big day. So think about the message you're sending to your guests, and I'd still recommend paper for now.
Anna Post on the digital age and weddings. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Anna Post is an author and etiquette expert. And we're asking you, how has technology changed your romantic relationships?
This is Ashley calling from Vancouver, Washington. 4 years ago, my boyfriend at the time said the words, "I love you," for the first time via a text message, and it worked for us. He's now my husband.
And we got some great stories about relationships that bloomed online. From Ocala, Florida, "I met my soon-to-be wife on an online dating site rather than through conventional means, and we only lived 5 minutes apart for years without ever meeting." And then there were some not-so-great love stories. From Dallas, Texas, we got this text message: "Without the internet, my husband would not have found a girlfriend online, thousands of miles away." Well, we know how technology has changed our relationship with all of you. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anoush Zomorodi, host of WNYC's New Tech City, in for John Hockenberry, and this has been The Takeaway.